You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 198. The first draft of everything is crap. Ernest Hemingway.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Well, guys, today we have on the show returning champion Chris Riley. Now, Chris was on the show before to talk about screenwriting format, but this time we're here to talk about his new book, The Defining Moment, how to create defining moments in characters and how you're able to use that to develop the character throughout the story. And Chris and I had a fantastic conversation about how to just craft characters that pop off the screen. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Chris Riley. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Chris Riley. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. It's good to see you again, Alex.
Good to see you, my friend. Last we spoke, we talked about formatting and the Hollywood standard and how to format a script properly. And that was a very successful conversation and episode. People really loved it. And when you wrote your new book, The Defining Moment, How to Write, was it how writers and actors build character? I had to have you back on the show to talk about it because it's a really fascinating book on the process of character development.
It's been a fun book to write, and it's fun to talk about. Talking about script format is a little
dry,
epic, but
a little dry.
Yeah, in this book, we get to sort of go straight for the heart.
The more sexy parts of writing is like that's formatting, not so sexy.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's necessary, but that's not what draws us to stories. It's the characters. And that's what this book is about.
Absolutely. So let's get into it. How do you build deep characters, in your opinion?
Well, it's such an important part of the work we do as storytellers. Characters are the most interesting thing, and it makes sense. Characters represent people, and people are the most interesting thing. So the challenge for a storyteller, for a writer, is that people and characters are complex. There's an infinite amount of stuff you could know about them. But what do we really need to know to go deep with characters? And the idea of the book is that there are a small number of moments that define each one of us, that define a character. And if we know what those moments are that have been the moments that have most profoundly shaped a character, then we can get a deep understanding of them without knowing a million details about them.
So you're talking, so that the definition of a defining moment, or what is a defining moment?
So a defining moment would be one of those moments that creates a before and after for us, that, you know, we were one thing before that moment, we're something else after it. So it can be a moment of birth or death, like literal or figurative. It can be a moment, you know, we're talking to filmmakers here, the moment when the birth or the dream of making movies was born. And you're one way before that. And then after that, you're hustling, you're obsessed. And you, but like nobody really could be said to understand you deeply if they don't know what that moment was.
So Bruce Wayne was hunky-dory until that night at the theater.
Exactly. So that's a moment where something died. Literally, his parents died, but something else was born in him, which was his drive to stop crime, to prevent other people from suffering the way he suffered. It was also the birth of his lifelong emotional agony.
I mean, he's got some issues. I mean, he's dressed up to the bat. So there's other psychological things that he's going to have to deal with growing up. But you know, I think the great defining moments in Hollywood history or in films, a lot of it comes around death, the death of a parent, the death of Uncle Ben for Spider-Man in Star Wars, the death of his family, and forcing him to go with Obi-Wan to, you know, train and so on. That seems to be a big catalyst. Can you give me an example of birth and how birth, I mean, obviously, when a child is born into your life, life changes. But that's in real life, because I know I was one person before my kids were born. I'm definitely a person after the kids are born. A few more wrinkles and a few more gray hairs. But in movies, though, are there examples that you can kind of give for the audience?
Well, so we can think about the events in Finding Nemo surrounding the birth of Nemo. There's death that precedes that. It's really a traumatic scene to open a children's movie with.
Pretty rough.
a barracuda shows up and eats mom and several hundred of the babies, and just leaves dad, Marlin, and one little egg, Nemo. And so Nemo's birth represents the opportunity for life to go on, for Marlin to build a family, but he also carries with him the damage of his losses. And so often, you know, birth and death are linked. Death clears the decks for something new to come. The death of Bruce Wayne's parents leads to the birth of Batman. Key is you can't understand Bruce Wayne if you don't know that moment of death that has defined him.
Yeah, because if you look at, you know, I'll use Spider-Man as an example. I mean, what was so brilliant of what Stan Lee wrote in that first issue was, what would you do if you had superpowers as a kid? The first thing you're going to do is not fight crime. First thing you're going to do is like show off, and how can I get rich? How can I get chicks? How can, like, that's a teenage boy's mind. It's exactly what he did. And, you know, he went to go fight and he won. But when he was so self-involved, he let that burglar or that robber run by him. And then later that guy kills Uncle Ben, which then sets him on his path. So that was so brilliantly done, because he needed that catalyst, or else who knows where Spider-Man would have gone without the death of Uncle Ben. He might have gone into debauchery and gone down a dark path where he could have very easily turned into a villain if he would have just kept going down the self-indulgent, egotistic way of going about things. So Uncle Ben's death was absolutely necessary for his character development.
Yeah, it was absolutely defining. And really, we've got two defining moments there in that story. We've got the death of Uncle Ben, which sets Spider-Man's course. But before that, we have the moment when Spider-Man is born in response to the bite of the spider. So we have to understand both of those moments if we're going to have an understanding of what's up with Peter Parker.
And why does he do what he does and how he does it and so on. And what I always find fascinating about story, it's such a complete analogy for our own journeys. The hero's journey is our journey. Everything that characters go through in movies and in books and novels and comic books, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, we go through in our own lives. We all have birth moments. We all have death moments. We all have defining moments of what make us who we are. I was so funny when I wrote my first book, Shooting for the Mob, which is about me almost making a $20 million movie for the mafia. I said, we could talk about that later. When I announced it on the show, I go, if you guys want to know what my origin story is, this is why I do what I do. And if it wasn't through that horrific experience that I went through and all of the shrapnel that I've picked up since being in the film industry, that's what prepared me to do a show like this, to speak the way I speak about the business, because I'm speaking from a place of being in the trenches and going through it. And then also having an urge to help others not have to go through those things. So I said it out loud, like, this is my origin story. If you want to know where the grizzled voice comes from, this is it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's so fascinating when we learn those things about one another or even about ourselves. And so I think it's fair to say that your closest friends, the people who understand you most deeply, know that story about you. And if they don't know that story, they're more of an acquaintance. And to the extent that we can excavate our own defining moments and face up to them, sometimes they're painful moments that we don't want to look at, we understand and know ourselves more deeply, and we can then draw on those things when we shape and develop characters. So whether we're actors, directors, writers, we are then drawing on the real stuff of life rather than being derivative of something that we saw someone else do.
I mean, those moments in our lives when we are tested, like the metal gets stronger the more that you beat down on it, the more it's heated, the more it's beaten, the more it gets stronger and stronger. So those defining moments in our lives really do shape who we are. And if you could take those experiences in your own life and add them into your story, that's when you have really deep characters, really deep story. That's not, like you said, derivative. I always, and I've said this 1,000 times in the show, and please forgive me, audience, but Shawshank Redemption, again, it's one of those movies that has no reason to be as good as it is. On paper, not anything particularly, mind-blowing. Horrible name. One of the worst titles of a movie ever. And yet, when you watch it, it touches you in a way. And it touches everybody, no matter... I saw it when I was a knucklehead in my early 20s. And my knucklehead friends even felt something, And I was like, if it can connect to that kind of mentality, what did Darabont do in the script that made those characters so, so vibrant to the point that they connect with us on such a almost spiritual level, honestly? And if we want to look at Andy Dufresne, I mean, his defining moments, the finding out his wife is cheating on him, defining moment number one. Two, being charged with a crime he didn't commit. That pretty much sets, those are two big defining moments. But there are some defining moments within the story that he decides, I'm going to fight back. And I'm going to, and then also the moment that he finds out, spoiler alert, that The Rock is weak. Those are, I mean, are those the defining moments in that movie?
I think they are. Some of them have to do with plot, finding out that you can cut into the rock wall. The opportunities are different after you know that.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
There's this, beautiful defining moment when he makes his escape. Oh. And we can think about all the ways his life is different before and after. Sure. He's a prisoner. He is without hope. We actually believe that he may have taken his own life.
Right. That's so beautiful. They milk that.
Yeah.
So beautifully.
And so he is at a moment of death, but he goes through this, all different kinds of transformative imagery. He passes through a birth canal.
Oh, yeah.
Into life. He has a baptism. It's a baptism in the sewage.
Life. The sewage of life.
And then he comes out. He comes clean. Out clean, he says. That is a life transformed. When we see him next on the beach in Mexico, he's a new man.
Yeah. And so is Red.
Yeah, Red is also transformed, and Red is also at that place where he could tip into death or push into life. And so he has wrestled with this idea of hope and the danger. How dangerous is hope? And he's a guy who rejects hope in the before version of himself. But when he decides that he is going to go and get that message that's buried in the wall, he is choosing hope. He's choosing life. That is a defining moment of healing. Now, I think the reason that it reaches us knuckleheads is because it's credible. I think it's drawn from life. And that's the great thing. If I can identify not only moments where I got broken or where I got damaged, but moments where I actually grew and experienced some restoration or healing, then I can draw on that and create credible moments for my characters that the audience will recognize and say, oh yeah, me too. That is how life is.
Yeah. I've said that as well, that I feel that story specifically is an analogy for life in many ways, that we many times feel like things are thrown up. We're accused of things we didn't do, which could be, things happen to us and we're punished and it's not our fault. And how he's able to transcend that almost. I love the spiritual imagery that you used, is like going through the birth canal, being baptized, coming out free. There's so much subtext in that imagery and in that story that connects with arguably almost anybody who watches it, because I mean, it's now considered one of the, ranked according to IMDb, even sometimes higher than The Godfather, so it's really interesting. I always love using that as a movie to look at, because on paper, it makes no sense it's a very basic, it's not a horror, like, okay, guy, he's accused of something he didn't commit, goes through jail, escapes, life is good. It's not, I mean, complex on paper, on the pitch.
No, the plot is not what's great about it.
It's the characters.
It's the character transformation. So we both reveal character, but we also then transform character. And defining moments are the basis of who we are when the story begins, but they are also the way then that we are transformed. So they both form the character, but also transform the character. And storytelling concerns itself with both of those processes.
So when you're writing a character, how do you discover what their defining moment is? So like when Bob Kane, or I forgot they just discovered someone else who wrote Batman, writes Batman, like, what's the thing? Like, I want to dress this guy up as a bat, but what does it cause this guy? What has to happen for this guy to dress up as a bat and fight crime? So like, how do you discover that moment for your characters?
Well, I think you do start with that kind of question. Like, I know I have a character who's going to dress up like a bat and fight crime. Why? So that's both a dream or a drive, a goal, but it's also there's damage. And so what sort of moment, what sort of experience gives rise to that? The way that you find the answer, I think, is not by resorting to reading other people's comic books or watching movies, because then your work is just derivative. I think you look to your own life experience. Why do I do what I do? Why do I go to the crazy lengths I go to achieve my goals? And why am I so messed up? And how does that happen? And out of that, you end up with something that is real and that is relatable, because, like, don't we all swim through a river of sewage hoping to come out clean on the other end? Aren't we all? Yeah, as you say, we're suffering with shame, much of which somebody else dumped on us. Mm-hmm. And yet, how do you get clean? And so we can look to if we will do the hard work, first of looking at our own moments that have defined us, and then pausing when we have this great idea of a man who dresses as a bat, what a great vigilante, and we can just rush headlong without pausing and asking ourselves the question you asked, why? How did he get to be this guy? And if we do that, and we think, yeah, there's probably a handful of moments that have defined him. We look for those until we recognize a moment that rings true to us, and then you grab onto that.
It's fascinating. I want to bring two characters, two very, very famous characters into the conversation: Indiana Jones and James Bond. Now, James Bond had multiple movies without really us knowing anything about him. Indiana Jones had two movies before we really truly knew why he does what he does, and which was going to bring me to my next question. Can a character have a defining moment outside of the current story that happens before the story? And I think the answer is, I'm going to answer my same, the question I think is yes, if we use those two examples, because if you look at Indiana Jones, the third part, we discover his relationship with his father. And that one moment in when he was a kid, where he, you know, the cross and all of that stuff with the guy and the quasi Indiana Jones that he met when he was a kid, launched him on his path. And then with James Bond, it was Casino Royale. And those are two, probably, I argue, Casino Royale is probably the best Bond movie because there's so much character in it. And it's not just, I'm cool, I have a gun, I sleep with a lot of women, which is basically what James Bond was for, you know, decades. And then Indiana Jones, you have that loving back and forth between him and Sean Connery is probably one of the most beloved of the Indiana Jones series. Do you agree with what I'm saying?
I do. And I think that when you find out the defining moments for your characters, you don't do it in a sort of a cynical, oh, that'll be a good scene and that'll, I can put that, you know, great end of act two, but you're seeking to understand the character. You don't know how you're going to play those moments, or if you're going to play those moments. In the book, I talk about my experience on the set of the movie Twister. And that movie was rushed into production before the script was finished. Helen Hunt plays this obsessive storm hunter who's trying to place scientific instruments inside a killer tornado, which is a dangerous, obsessive thing to do. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene from her childhood in the movie where you come to understand why she does that. Well, that scene had not been written when I was on location with them. Mm-hmm. And they had decided we'll write that later because we're not going to shoot it until later. So you can imagine Helen Hunt, the actor, running around chasing tornadoes, putting herself at risk. And you could imagine that it would actually help her performance.
She might have done it in her own head, though. She created that backstory.
Well, because she's an Oscar-winning great performer, so she probably created that for herself. But wouldn't it be better if she knew that? Wouldn't it potentially shape her performance if she knew that moment, even though it might never appear on screen? And for writers and directors as well as actors, I think that knowing those moments that have shaped your characters, whether or not they appear on screen, helps you know what they'll do, what they'll say, and why they will say and do it. Many of those moments do end up coming into the story one way or another, but I would say maybe half of the moments that I developed for my characters, really, I'm the only one who will ever know them. But I can write that character so much better. And I have more compassion for that character. So I'm not writing, even my antagonist, I'm not writing with contempt for them. I'm writing with a sense of empathy for them because I know what they've been through.
Well, and that's the thing about writing good villains, and is that a good villain is not a villain in their own story. Nobody is the villain in their own story. We're all the heroes in our story. Even if you're doing gnarly stuff in the world and bad stuff in the world, you are the villain. So I always find it, when you have the villain that is twisting their mustache at the railroad tracks, that's not very interesting. But you got someone like Thanos, who truly is actually trying to help the universe, but he's going about it the wrong way. Snapping half of it out of existence is probably not the smartest way of going about it. But he actually has good intentions, if you will. The Joker, the movie Joker, my God, you go into such deep understanding of the torture of that soul and you get it. You actually identify. Joker's the hero of that movie. Which is, he's the anti-hero. Wolverine, another anti-hero. Deadpool, the Punisher, these kind of superhero characters. But the greatest villains are always the ones that have the most traumatic or damaging backstories that you feel for them. You feel for Darth Vader. You don't feel for him in Star Wars The New Hope when you first see him. You start to feel him a little bit more in Empire. And then you truly feel them in Return of the Jedi. And then when you go back to the prequels, which we generally don't like to talk about, but there are some moments in those films that you go, oh, okay, I get why he is the way he is. So those are, when anyone listening, please, when you're writing villains, write something. They have to have a good reason for doing what they're doing.
They really believe in the justice of their cause, even though it may be
twisted,
completely evil and destructive in its outflow. Michael Corleone is another great example of someone who does horrible things, destroys his family in the name of saving it. And yet, because that storytelling so brilliantly brings us along his journey, including in that moment in the middle of the first Godfather film where he picks up a gun and guns down the two men responsible for his father's shooting, that is the moment that makes Michael the Godfather. And without that moment, you don't understand it. With that moment, you go with him on that journey, even though you're kind of, you know, you're watching through your fingers and you're recoiling at what he's doing. And with Kay at the end of that first Godfather film, you recognize, oh, Michael is now a monster. But like, I'm fascinated and I get it. And it's because I was privy to the moments that shaped and transformed him.
I mean, well, Tony Soprano. I mean, look at Tony Soprano. And there is a scene in, I think, episode 5 or 6 that HBO had a major problem with. It was a moment. It was a defining moment in his character where I think there was a rat or something along those lines. And he found the rat and literally killed him on screen, choked him to death.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
On screen, vividly, the camera was in. No one had ever done that before on a television show. Like, it was so brutal. And that's the defining moment for that character in the series. And it's also a defining moment for the audience. Because you got to go, am I going to follow this guy? Like, am I going to keep watching this monster? You know, because he's not a good guy and the whole show's about him and his family and what he goes through. So I feel that there was that was such a wonderful moment that David Chase brought in, and he fought for it big time, that because the HBO says, like, you're going to lose the audience. And he's like, no, we're not. He knew more about the character and the audience than anybody else did. Even the audience didn't even know what they wanted until they saw it.
Exploring interesting characters who are like us in some way, revealing their secrets. I mean, that's such a draw to us as an audience. I really think that, you know, one of our giant drives as people is to know, to connect. And that's really hard in real life. People don't share their secrets with us. You know, you're at Starbucks and you go, so, you know, what was your most wounding moment that defined you?
I had those conversations all the time, Chris. I don't know what you're talking about.
they tend to edge away from you.
Right.
But great storytelling, great movies, great television allows us to know some characters better than we know our closest friends. And I really do think we're hungry for that.
I think that connection is, you're right. We all want connection. You know, we're all striving to connect with other human beings and in a deep, meaningful way. And when there's lack of that in our lives, we connect with the characters in movies. I know I did when I was growing up. You know, when you don't have friends, you can still pop in a VCR tape. That's how old I am. And watch Indiana Jones or watch a movie and go on an adventure and connect with those characters. I mean, look at the Rocky. I mean, Jesus, you know, a movie like that still holds up from, there's very few movies from the 70s that can be watched today and still has the same impact that it did back then. Rocky is that story. I mean, if you want to talk about defining moments in his story, I mean, the moment Apollo Creed shows up and says, hey, do you want a shot? Pretty big defining moment.
Absolutely. He was a failed boxer sleepwalking through life, and someone opens a door of opportunity for him. And he would talk about his life. If you interviewed him later on, he would say, well, before Apollo came along, this is me. After, this is me. And that, for me, is the great telltale sign of any defining moment, that it creates this boundary of before and after. So, a family would talk about, that was before the house burned down. That was after the house burned down, before the diagnosis, after the diagnosis, before we met, after we met. It's not all sad. Some of the stuff is good, you know, before therapy, after therapy. And it is in discovering those things that we recognize the person, and we also recognize ourselves and realize, oh, I'm not the only one. I'm not alone. And that is, that's the great relief that comes from connecting with characters, is just discovering like, oh, other people are struggling like me. And then when Rocky Balboa is able to find meaning and triumph in life,
maybe I can too.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, isn't that interesting though? That story is something that is so integral to us as a species. We're the only ones on the planet who tell stories, truly tell stories. I'm not sure what some of the apes do, but I don't think they tell, you know, they're not telling Batman stories. But we tell stories. It's not only that we tell stories, it's that we need story in our life. We need that expression of this journey to help us understand what the hell this whole life thing is. It's a way for us to grasp onto something, because we show up and this is a mess. And most of us walk through life as, this is a mess. All this stuff is happening to me. I'm going through tragedy. I'm going through highs and lows. What does this all mean? You're trying to find meaning in what you're doing, and story provides that. And it doesn't have to be a complex novel or movie or comic book. It could be like, did you hear what happened to Bob down the street? That little gossip of what might have happened, a tiger ate him around the corner. Well, there's a value to that concept. Like, don't go down the corner because there are tigers down there and they can eat you. So there's that function of it. But I think that, I mean, without story, I don't even know how we would function as a human being.
Yeah, I don't think we can. And I think that one of the insights of neurology is that when we lose track of our own stories of ourselves, we can't remember. If we've got, say, Alzheimer's disease, and we can't remember our stories, we're not just losing contact with our history. We're actually losing contact with our identity, because our identity is built out of our stories, the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. And as you say, we're also looking at the cause and effect of, like, why did that happen and what does it all mean? So a story that could look like a very lightweight comic book story may really be, like, philosophically undergirding our whole sense of the meaning of life. That's what it's getting at, is what does it add up to? And the most satisfying stories help us understand what the events of the story add up to.
And also, when you are able to go on a ride with a character and live vicariously through the character, it's a way for you to kind of almost disconnect as well, obviously, from your day-to-day stuff. But there's sometimes when, especially when you're younger, you watch a movie and it just hits you in a way that you can't let go. I mean, Shawshank was that for me, believe it or not. I mean, I know it's just one of those movies that doesn't let go of me. The Matrix was one of those films. Fight Club was one of those films. They don't let go of you. There's concepts in it that connect with you in a weird way. You know, I don't connect with Tyler Durden, you know, but a lot of the concepts and ideas that Fincher and Jim Ouls and the writer Chuck was trying to portray in that story connected with me personally, and The Godfather and those kind of films. There's just those things. But at the end of the day, it always comes back down to character, because how many people can truly remember plots from James Bond?
Yeah, not interesting.
How many plots do we really remember from James Bond, other than maybe something you just saw? You don't really remember plots. I vaguely kind of remember the plot of Temple of Doom, vaguely. But I remember key moments mm-hmm. that have to do with character.
Yeah, yeah. Kathy, my wife and co-author of The Defining Moment, and I draw heavily on Band of Brothers, World War II series. There's so many life lessons from those characters. We think about, there's a battle scene with a terrible leader who sort of bogs down in the middle of battle, and Winters, our main character, just keeps shouting at him, keep moving forward. You have to keep moving forward. And that refrain of keep moving forward in the face of battle, of danger, of resistance, that's something that we draw on. And then there's during the Battle of the Bulge, there's the troops have just been, they're being shelled for days and days and days. And there's just a little line in narration that says, if a man could just get off the front lines, even for an hour, it made such a difference. And we will sometimes, when we are engaged and it feels like we're on the front lines of the battle of life, we'll look at each other and say, I think we need to get, 45 minutes away from the front lines just to catch our breath and
decompress.
Yeah. And so those lessons of life don't stay on the screen. We incorporate them into our actual lives.
I mean, George Lucas said it very, very distinctly when he wrote Star Wars and he used the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell laid out. He did it so perfectly according to Joseph Campbell's work. He's like, stories are the meat and potatoes of society. And, that's what keeps these big lessons, these big ideas moving forward. You know, there'll be generations who will watch that movie or read that story about Star Wars. And there's obscene amounts of life lessons that maybe you and I would look at and go, oh, that's, we completely understand that. We know that, we've been through it. It's not that big of a, but imagine you're 15 watching that for the first time. And you really haven't had those kind of lessons before about life. That's pretty profound. And it just really is.
Yeah. For me, when I was in that age range, movies are some of my defining moments because they taught me things about life that I didn't know. They were the first really well-made movies that I had ever seen. And the impact on me was life-changing. I can say, there's me before I saw Ordinary People and The Deer Hunter, and there's me after.
Deer Hunter. Wow.
And the me after wants to make movies and to do that. The me after also understands that I'm not the only one who struggles because those movies taught me that. And the me after also understands that because other people struggle, even though they don't look like it, they look like they have it all together. Mm-hmm. I got to treat people with more compassion. And so I'm a different person in those three important ways after watching those two films. But those are defining moments.
But according to Instagram, everyone's having a fantastic time. It's just me that's having a horrible life. I'm just saying.
Right. And so Instagram will not tell you the truth. That's either a newsflash or a spoiler alert. But but stories can. I mean, I think stories can also lie to us and send us chasing after mirages. But good storytelling can tell us the truth about us, about life.
Now, you speak about in the book, the awakening of longing in a character. How do you awaken longing in a character? Because I know so many of us, just as human beings walking the earth, in so many ways, we're lost looking for that meaning in life, looking for that thing that we're here to do. And it's so painful, become bitter and angry because you're not getting what you want. But when you happen to fall into the thing that the doors open, that you're happy, you wake up in the morning, you're happy to go do it. That's what we're all searching for. We're also searching to be happy with our day-to-day business. Truly. I mean, in every way possible, in our relationships with our family, career-based, we're looking for happiness. But to find that meaning, and to also awaken the longing to find that meaning is not very easy. It took me a minute to figure out. Some get it when they're born. They know at 4 years old, I'm going to sing, and they become Mariah Carey. Or they're 65 and start KFC. Like Colonel Sanders did. He started at 65. He's like, I think I'm going to start a new company. And he was 65 when he started it. So obviously it took him a minute to figure out what his purpose and purpose was to make chicken.
Yeah, I'm a delicious chicken.
Yes, very healthy.
I, I think that one of the characteristics of defining moments is that we don't make them happen. They sort of happen to us. Mm-hmm. Bruce Wayne's, the death of his parents happened to him. But, and so the, like a moment that awakens a deep longing in us is not something that we can order up.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But I, as an example of a moment where a longing was awakened, I think of my wife Kathy's story of, as a child, she had a dad who was not warm, who she cannot recall him ever saying the words, "I love you." Mm-hmm. And I don't know that she knew what she was missing, because, you know, life is normal to you as a kid, whatever it is. And then she was at a wedding sitting between her uncle and her aunt. And her uncle was the handsome uncle, the cool uncle. And he looked at Kathy. He looked at his own wife. And he said, "I'm sitting between the two most beautiful women in the world." Kathy had never been spoken to that way. And as soon as she heard those words, something woke up in her that said, "Oh, that's the kind of man I want to spend my life with." Now, this is a little bit of a self-serving story since I'm the husband.
I was about to say, how did you end up in this story, Chris?
So I'm not, we'll leave it to her to say whether that longing was satisfied. But that was something then that stayed with her mm-hmm. forever.
Sure.
It wasn't there the moment before, and then it was there the moment after. Not because she chose for it to be, because that experience awakened that longing in her. Now she can write characters who have a moment like that, drawing on her own experience, and it will be credible, because it draws on that authentic emotional experience of her life.
It's so funny because I look back when I was 18 and I was like, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And one day I literally sat down in my bedroom. I looked around and I had 3,000 VHS tapes that I had collected. Wow. I worked in a video store. So I collected about 3,000 in my collection at the time. I looked around and I said, "I like movies. I guess I'm going to be a director." And that was it. And that was the moment. And this was also in a time that it wasn't cool to be directors. There wasn't YouTube. There wasn't a lot of information about writing or direct. I don't even think Sid Field might have just come out. Like, there wasn't a lot of information.
Yeah, that was about the first one, though. And it was tough to learn anything.
Right. There was just, it was not. So it wasn't like in the zeitgeist of like filmmaking. That's a career option. You know, my parents were like, what? Like, so, but that was the moment. I never forgot that moment. I was like, I guess I'm going to be a director. And that was, I was before that moment and after that moment. And that was it.
Right. And it's lasting. I mean, it's, here we are sitting about,
for better or worse, talking about for filmmaking. Better or worse, sir, for better or worse, it's still going, because it has been, and it's, you know, I've documented it well. And I think every filmmaker and screenwriter goes through this. It's not an easy path. It is not an easy path to go down. To be an artist in general, it's not an easy path. But speaking of defining moments, that was the moment that I decided. And then there was other defining moments that you decide, do I want to keep going or not? How do I keep going or not?
Yeah.
And that's also very difficult to understand. And like, you, again, we'll go back to Shawshank. How does Andy Dufresne keep going? 20 years. Of or 30, 25 years, whatever it was, he was in there going through that day in and day out. And Red, just that little montage, so beautiful, when Red's like, some days were good, some days were bad. You know, some days he fought off the sisters and won. Some days he fought off the sisters and lost. And he goes, I would have feared that he wouldn't have made it if things kept going that way. But one day this happened. And then this character gets introduced and his whole life changes inside the prison, because now he can go off and someone needs to cook the books. He's good at that. his life changed from that moment on. But those are those things.
Yeah, and life, that quality of life, that there are these seismic moments of shifting.
Right.
And then there are long periods of silence. And life consists of both things. The moment the volcano erupts, or that the fault ruptures and we have an earthquake, those are the exciting moments. They're terrifying, dangerous, but exciting. It's much harder on film to render the long expanses of just keep at it, just keep scraping away with that rock hammer, digging that tunnel. And yet life, you know, to be fair, consists of more of those moments. But those are not generally the ones we tell. I talk to students about that. I say, you can look at my CV or my list of credits, and it looks like I've had this, you know, great, exciting life. But I have to tell you, you know, look at the dates. There are gaps.
5 years.
Yes. I talk about my time at Warner Brothers, in the script department, and I was able to write the Hollywood Standard based on all that I learned there. But there were long days of me, you know, just reading script after script after finding typos, or sitting alone in the middle of the night. We've got 300 copies of script revisions for the Dukes of Hazzard, and someone has to paperclip them. And that doesn't end up in the credits list, but most of life is that in-between stuff. And so, yeah, I admire Shawshank Redemption for finding a way to give a nod to that, because that's where, like, most people listening to us right now are in those in-between moments. If they're in the middle of a defining moment, they don't have time to listen to us.
Maybe this podcast is a defining moment for them.
It can be. I think it can be.
It can be like, wait a minute. I've listened to podcasts before, and I'm like, I've never thought of story that way before. You know, I remember talking to John Truby, and I was like, oh my God, he just, something clicked after I talked to him. I was like, I never thought of story that way. The plot, the way he explained it. I was like, oh, and other people will read other books, and other people will watch a movie and go, oh, I get something now. So there are moments. This could be a defining moment. I'm not putting any pressure on this episode, Chris. But I
think it can be. And and if, you know, if today is one of those in-between days, then we have to take that lesson from Band of Brothers and keep moving forward.
Yeah, it's like Rocky Balboa says, how hard can you get hit and keep moving forward? And that's what, in many ways, what life is all about. It's about being able to take the hits and keep moving forward. And it's such a great talk he does in the movie Rocky Balboa. He does this like 3-minute monologue, and it's all about life and how hard life hits you and it brings you to your knees. And what are you going to do? Are you going to get up and keep going? Or are you just going to lie there? And in your story, all that mundane work that you did in the story department, sometimes I'm sure it was a lot of fun, but all those in between moments, that is what prepared you to write the Hollywood Standard. Without that stuff, you couldn't have moved in the direction that you are right now.
That's exactly right. And all of the scripts I read are what taught me how to write scripts. So I couldn't have gotten to where I am now without that. And, you know, writing a book, there's a lot of sitting alone.
Yes, there is.
I wonder what the next word is. And oh my gosh, there are a lot of words on the page of a book compared to a script page that's mostly air.
Yeah, I remember. It's like, how many words? 50,000, 55,000 words I got to do. Okay. It's a lot of words. All right. We'll try to do 500 to 1,000 a day. Let's just start cranking it out and just start keep moving and take a bite of the elephant a day.
Yeah, exactly. There's I don't know where this phrase came from. I heard it from my wife. And the phrase is embrace radical incrementalism.
Just the idea that
you're just going to take, yeah, one bite of the elephant a day. You can eat a whole elephant that way if you keep it up over time. So I've learned even working a full-time job at Warner Brothers, if I wrote every day and whatever minutes I could scrape together, I could write a movie every year. And over time, that added up to my career breakthrough and the script that was the one that we sold first. But we were, you know, overnight successes after 14 years of taking a bite of the elephant. And that's the difference between the people who get there and the people who don't, is you, the people who get there just kept going.
Well, and I think you can attest to this. In this business, it's not the most talented that wins. It's the one who doesn't stop. Because there's a lot of people who are not as talented who are working in the business right now, making big movies, who aren't the best writers in the world, but they're the ones that just kept showing up and they just kept pounding it and kept pounding it and kept pounding, grinding it out, where someone who was very talented just maybe didn't have it in them to keep going. It was too hard for them, but they were more technically more talented than that. I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen it.
Yeah, no, I see that as well. The one who quits cannot win. They definitely take themselves out of the running. It's only the ones who keep going who are in the place where they've developed their skills to the level they need to be, and they've done the work, and they, you can't sell a script that you didn't finish. And in almost any case that I'm aware of, you can't sell a script that you didn't finish a bunch of drafts of. And, you know, if you're a director, so many things that you have to figure out and get to go right to finish any film, to finish a good film. Oh, my gosh, it's a miracle. And then that there are great films, is that shouldn't be possible. And yet we know there are great films.
Yeah, and I just want to put a myth to rest, the Rocky story of the script being written in 5 days or something like that. You've heard that story, obviously, right?
I've heard other stories along those lines that usually involve like the back of a cocktail napkin.
But he wrote that. He apparently wrote the script, according to Sly. He's like, I wrote Rocky in 5 days. That was draft one. But he did get the first draft out because it was so... He just didn't stop. And it wasn't like 3 hours here, 2 hours there. He sat down for 12 or 15 hours a day and just beat it out. And then beat the hell out of the drafts again and again and again and again afterwards. So there's no genius. There's no Mozarts of screenwriting. There's a couple who feel like it, like Tarantino and Sorkin and Kaufman, but all of them work at it. All of them, really.
People work really hard. And I think any good movie or television episode consists of hundreds of really good ideas. And it takes time to have those good ideas, to collect them, to squeeze out all the hot air, all the stuff that's not brilliant. And so you end up like reading a great script, seeing a great film and going, oh my gosh, that person's a genius. No, they just work harder than you. And they just kept at it until they had enough good ideas to fill the thing up.
Well, I mean, if you look at Tarantino, who everyone's like, everyone tries to emulate his writing. No one can ever emulate his writing because he had, what, 20 years of reading every novel, watching every movie, doing the amount of work that he put in to be able to have the vast and the ability to retain all that information in his head and retrieve it at will is a talent that doesn't exist. He's an anomaly. He's a genius in that sense. But even that, I know people who work with him and he is fairly brilliant, but he does work at it. Like he doesn't just, Inglourious Basterds wasn't written in one pass. Like they go back, you know, Eric Roth didn't write Forrest Gump in one pass. He goes back and beat it up again and beat it up again and beat it up again. But someone like Tarantino, like that, you know, all those years you reading at Warner Brothers, it's him working at a video store, him reading every novel. Without all that information, he can't be who he is. He can't write Pulp Fiction.
That's yeah. No, that's exactly right. I was at the Disney Concert Hall recently to hear Itzhak Perlman play his violin. Yeah. And for him, it looks like it's effortless. And in that moment, I think it sort of is effortless, but that's because it's built on decades of practice, work, mastery. And then, yes, you get to go and you get to play.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And you're able to do it, but only because you've done all of that work to reach mastery, where you can sort of dance on top of all of the skill and the discipline.
I feel very comfortable having a podcast now after doing 700 plus or 800 podcasts at this point in my career. And I have no issue. First year, lot different conversation, much more nervous, much more, but you start building skill sets on how to talk to people, how to feel them out, all this stuff just comes in, but it's just grinding it out. It's just grinding it out to the point where now they're like, oh, I can jump on with it. I'm not intimidated by anybody when I interview. And trust me, I've interviewed a couple that have been intimidating to say the least, but you feel very comfortable in the space you're in. Like, no one's going to come to you, you're not going to feel uncomfortable about format. There's nothing really that could be thrown at you about format that's going to shake you, generally speaking.
That's right. I'm very comfortable. I'd stand up in front of any audience and feel formatting questions, because I spent 14 years fielding formatting questions. And so I have learned how to answer those.
Now, in the book also, you talk about Dr. Schauer's 8 character traits. Can you talk about those?
Yeah. So Sidney Schauer's is a Minnesota-based pediatrician who came to LA to learn TV writing and is really a very good writer. And she talked to me about these 8 character traits that she just kind of collected this list. They come from different places. And some of them overlap, you know, what other people talk about, but I think it's a really useful grid to use to think about a character, just to prompt yourself to have more good ideas. So she thinks about, what is the character's drive? And that's different from their goal. Their drive is just what keeps them going, whether or not there's a story happening. So for Michael Corleone, she thinks his drive is to please his father. Whether or not his father's still alive, he's still driven to please his father. And then the character's goal, character, you know, has to be going after something. She thinks about a character's genius, which is really interesting to think that every character is really strong in some area. So Forrest Gump's genius obviously is not high IQ, but he tells us what it is. He says, I may not be a smart man, but I know what love is. So Forrest Gump's genius is love and the way he loves Jenny, his purity of heart. That's a great thing to think about. And then, what is the character's most closely guarded or embarrassing secret? That assumes that we all have one. And I think that's probably a safe bet. You know, what do we most not want people to know? What question do I most hope you don't ask me? What will reveal me as a fraud? Mm-hmm. And so that sometimes will certainly motivate a villain to protect a secret, might motivate a protagonist to protect a secret. Mm-hmm. And then there's, what's the character's flaw? What is their weakness? So the flaw might be more of a sort of a moral failing. They're selfish, they're arrogant, whatever. Their weakness is the Achilles heel. It's not a moral failure, but it's, you know, it's their kryptonite. What is that? What's their redeeming quality? Why do we forgive those other things the way we do our friends? Yeah, he's a bit of a jerk, but he was there for me when I was in the hospital. And so that redeeming trait is also useful to know, and I don't know if I've hit all eight of them, but it's just an example of a way that we can give ourselves prompts when we think about a character to give ourselves the opportunity to discover more.
So Hannibal Lecter, there's something so beautiful about his character because we like him, but he's a cannibal and a murderer.
So, well, there's that. Yeah.
There's that. But yet there's something redeeming about him. What is redeeming about Hannibal Lecter? Why do we cheer that he's going to eat somebody at the end of the movie?
Yeah. He...
I mean, it's insane, but you're sitting there going, yes, eat that son of a bitch.
he's charming.
That's a superpower. He does have that. Intelligence.
He's really smart.
Yeah.
Right. So his genius is his genius. And so we admire someone. He's working his plan. Clarice is using him. He's using her. And that's brilliant. And so we will be attracted to somebody who is very smart and who has a plan. Now, you know, why do we want him to eat someone at the end? I think that has more to do with we'll root for someone if they're up against someone who's even worse, even more horrible. And that's just sort of the sense of justice.
There is a little bit of justice, yeah.
I will root for any football team that is, you know, going up against Tom Brady, because for me, Tom Brady is the ultimate supervillain.
Sure.
The
Yankees were that for a the Yankees were that for a long time.
Exactly. And, you know, and I have to admire the guy. He is a great, great athlete. But, you know, for me, hearing that he's coming back, it's like, well, of course, it's the zombie movie where he's just, you can't kill the guy.
Listen, as a guy who's just a couple years older than him, I'm rooting for him. And I did not like the Patriots. I'm a Dolphin fan. I'm a very depressed Dolphin fan for many, many years. And when I heard he was coming back, I'm like, you know what? Just makes me feel good that a dude his age is out there doing it at that level. And that's just my connection to that story.
Well, and that's another huge key to understanding why we connect with characters. We relate to them. We identify with them. And now there's a bit of an underdog quality to he's fighting the clock.
He's fighting age. Now he's not Superman. He's an aged Superman who's now fighting against youth, against other football players who are in better shape, I guess. But he's at such a level of mastery that he can pull off what he's doing that nobody had ever pulled off and has ever pulled off in the history of the sport. So even though I wasn't a Tom Brady fan growing up, as he's now passed over that level, and you're right, he's now an underdog. I'm like, can he take a team back to the Super Bowl at his age? Can he fight that 22-year-old kid from Kansas City? Like, who's arguably one of the best quarterbacks playing in the game today. So it's fascinating, but you're absolutely right. I think, and I guess the older guys are looking at it a very different perspective than the younger guys are, because they don't understand what he's going through. They're like, just get him off the field. He's old. And we're like, nah, man, look what he's doing. He's giving us all hope that there's still hope for the rest of us.
Yeah, right. And so because we identify with him, then we're able to project ourselves into him as a character. And yeah, and then I know people are going to hear me say this, and so I shudder to say it, but I think I might root for a little bit of Tom Brady's success too, for that reason, in a way I never would have in the past.
And same here. I mean, he's caused me more heartache over the years with my Dolphins than anybody else has. And you were speaking about we're attracted to genius. I mean, I think one of the reasons genius or superpowers of one sort, and it doesn't have to be fit like real superpowers, superhero superpowers like Superman and things like that. But someone like Maverick from Top Gun, who's the new Top Gun movie is coming out this month, who I'm really interested to see what they do with that character, because in the first Top Gun, his superpower is his abilities, but he's arrogant. Mm-hmm. And there's all these flaws and weaknesses that he has to deal with. He has to fight the defining moment of his father's history, that baggage of him carrying his father. But we're attracted to greatness. We're attracted to highly skilled characters. So Rain Man, you know, Dustin Hoffman, who is, you know, autistic. Is autistic, right? Yeah, it's autistic.
Yes.
Autistic. And he has no other superpower other than what he's able to do. He's completely deficient in every other way socially that he can be. But yet we are attracted to him because of what he's able to do with his mind it seems superpower-like. And we're so attracted to that. And it was just like that movie, you know, if you have people who are younger who have not seen Rain Man, please go watch it. It's a masterpiece.
It's fantastic. And it's a script that we had in this, that came through the script processing department at Warner Brothers as they were working draft after draft after draft to crack the ending. So that's an example of a movie that was written over a long period of time. And then paradoxically, we're attracted to people's genius. We're also attracted to their vulnerability. And going back to Tom Brady, he's now vulnerable. He never was before. And now, because of his age, he's vulnerable. And that, for the first time, to me, makes him seem approachable and relatable to me. And so then that sort of combination of his genius and his humanity, his vulnerability, makes him interesting. And maybe James Bond is another example.
He becomes more
interesting to me when he's vulnerable than when, you know, if bullets bounce off of him, then how can I worry about him or relate to him?
Well, it's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to write for Superman and make a good Superman movie, because he's a god. He's walking around as a god. And that's issues with all the DC characters. They're all very godlike, you know, and where Marvel characters are much more vulnerable. There's not really many Marvel characters who are Superman, indestructible at all levels. They all have powers, but they all have weaknesses. You know, Peter Parker, super strong, but he can get shot. He also has acne, you know, and he's a teenage boy dealing with teenage boy stuff. So
that's it, makes him relatable to teenage boys.
Right. And that was the genius of Stan Lee, that what he was able to do with all of the characters that he created. He made it, even Thor, who is a god, literally a god, is very vulnerable, extremely vulnerable. And in a way that Superman has difficulty being. I think one of the writers of Superman said, you know, we knew we had a problem when we had him blow out a star. Because at that point, you're just like, it's not interesting seeing someone win all the time. You need to have some sort of adversity to make it interesting.
Yeah, you want a fair fight. You don't want to know how it's going to turn out.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, Chris, where can people pick up your new book, The Defining Moment?
Well, they can find it on Amazon. They can find it at the publisher's website, MWP.com, or they can go to thisdefiningmoment.com, which is the book's website.
Chris, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I always have a great time talking to you. This was more interesting than formatting, I'll give you that, as far as a conversation is concerned. But I appreciate you putting this book out, and hopefully this episode will be the defining moment in some screenwriter or filmmaker's life. So let's hope and pray.
I would really hope that that's true. Thanks for a great conversation, Alex.
I want to thank Chris so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Chris. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get Chris's new book, The Defining Moment, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/198. And by the way, I've heard from many of the tribe members that didn't know that this podcast is also a video podcast on the Indie Film Hustle YouTube channel. So if you want to check that out, all you've got to do is head over to indiefilmhustle.com/YouTube, and it'll take you right to the Bulletproof Screenwriting interviews, as well as Indie Film Hustle interviews, as well as the director series, and so many other amazing content to help you on your writing journey. So again, that's indiefilmhustle.com/YouTube. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.